It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, a book reviewer shines a light on the cultural and demographic shifts driving contemporary Midwestern fiction and shares some books for our reading list.
First, Governor Walker announced plans yesterday to increase funding of rural schools in Wisconsin. This came in the run-up to his two-year state budget plan, which he'll reveal next week.
Walker's Rural Schools Initiative would increase funding of rural schools by about $66.5 million in all, with special attention going to sparsely populated districts. Specific budget items include increased technology grant funding, broadband investment, additional transportation aid, as well as more support for school fabrication laboratories, or fab labs.
While rural school advocates largely hailed the move, opponents pointed out gaps in funding for sparsity aid and the need for better address teacher shortages. Democrats contrasted this move with overall public education cuts in recent budgets, which they say approached $1 billion.
Erin Richards joins us now. She's an education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, we laid out some of the broad strokes here. Can you give us some of the details of what's included in Governor Walker's rural schools proposal?
For at least a few years now, rural superintendents and folks who are connected with rural schools have largely asked for more resources for technology grants, technology funding. That's not just the broadband itself, but it's often the infrastructure to use broadband in schools. You also have sometimes a lack of internet access in people's homes. So part of this proposal is to provide more funding to allow districts to have mobile hotspots that children can actually take home with them to help them complete homework either on the bus or in their own homes. And you also have some more money set aside for these districts that are not just rural but also sparsely populated. So that means districts that have to transport kids long distances from their schools to their homes. And you also have some proposals in here aimed at trying to figure out ways to not only train more people to be teachers in rural areas, but ways to keep them there and keep them in the community. One problem facing our rural areas is that Wisconsin isn't adding a whole lot more people to its population. Overall, there's a slight decline. So you have areas that are sort of competing to keep people in the area, to keep good talent in schools. And one way to do that in the governor's proposal is to offer a new pathway that would be overseen by the UW system to allow teachers' aides in schools, who are generally people with some college education, maybe a bachelor's degree or less, but they work as aides in schools, and this would give them a pathway to train to become a full-time teacher and potentially continue to stay in that community as a teacher.
And we've seen a long-term structural problem for these rural schools where as enrollment is stagnant or declines, the school aid formula pays a certain amount per student, which means less money in those schools, but fixed costs. You still have to heat the whole building. You still have to run the same number of buses with less money. Is that part of the backdrop of what's causing some of these problems?
It absolutely is, and for every school district, I mean, you know this if you're in private industry too, health insurance costs go up every year. So even if you've made some pretty big changes in your health insurance administrator and benefits with the freedom that districts have now under Act 10 to pass those with less or no input from the union, you can only glean so many savings from that, and those costs go up every year, you know, whether you have 100 employees or, you know, 2,000 employees.
Talking to Erin Richards from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about what Governor Walker's been saying about his budget as it applies to school districts in rural parts of Wisconsin. Let's talk about the reaction some, Erin. First of all, what are we hearing from people who advocate for these schools in rural Wisconsin?
So lawmakers that have been on committees for the last couple of years to advocate for rural schools are applauding these as good first steps. A lot of the proposals are actually taken right out of what State Superintendent Tony Evers has asked for in his proposals. You've got a group called the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance. They have also asked for additional aid. This is additional per pupil aid for districts that educate kids in sparse areas. One myth that had been asked for by the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance was offering a little bit of extra funding for districts that educate up to 1,500 students. Walker instead capped that at districts that educate, you know, there was some additional aid for districts that are between 746 student enrollment and enrolling 1,000 students. The Alliance had asked for up to 1,500 because there's quite a few districts that kind of fall in between that window. That said, bumping it up from the 745 enrollment limit before was certainly seen as a welcomed move. And you also have the State School Boards Association, which has not always, you know, often has been at odds with what Walker's proposals are for schools, saying, thank you. Thank you for recognizing the needs of our schools and for offering a little bit more money in the budget here for them.
And we've talked to you in the past, and you mentioned just a few moments ago, the competition for teachers, these smaller schools, these rural schools, can't necessarily pay enough to keep teachers there, teachers who can go to more affluent school districts in Wisconsin or elsewhere. Is this enough money to make a difference for these schools?
I would say that it's a step forward, and it's seen as a positive step for districts that are really tight on funding. Is this enough? I don't know if we can say that yet. We've seen an increasing number of rural schools have to go to referendum and ask their communities to raise their own taxes simply for operating expenses. We've seen not only more and more of those operational referenda in recent years, but we've seen a great number of them actually be passed, which wasn't always the case before Act 10. So you certainly have communities that are saying, we don't have enough money to fund our schools. And in places where your communities rise up and recognize that need and approve that referendum, good for them. They have more money to use. But if you're in a district where your communities have not recognized that need or don't feel like they can financially recognize that need or fund that need, you know, those districts may be at even more of a disadvantage. The other problem is that there are some rural districts that don't meet the sparsity aid. Those are the sparsely, they're rural, but they're not sparsely populated, or they enroll above 1,500 students. They're not eligible for any of the extra per pupil funding. They might get a little bit more on the transportation money that's on the table, but I had talked to one rural district yesterday that I think they had about maybe 2,000 students. High school was about 400 or so. And the most that they would get out of this proposal was $5,000 extra for transportation. Certainly that's welcomed, but their total budget for transportation is, you know, about $900,000.
Well, what have we heard from Democrats in response to the governor's proposals?
Democrats did not lead with welcoming these proposals. What they led with was, look, Scott Walker, you have cut our schools since taking office in 2011. And the reason, you know, that they position it as you can't come out looking like a hero by offering $5 when, you know, by starting in 2011, you took $20 or $50 from us. So their praise for these was almost non-existent. It really started from the point that these schools should have their funding restored to 2011 levels before anyone should take credit for offering a boost. So we certainly heard that from the Democratic lawmakers yesterday that were not nearly as willing to praise these proposals as people in the schools community.
This was a kind of a preview of Governor Walker's budget that's coming out officially next week. What are you watching for next on this story of rural school funding?
So there's a possibility, we're hearing some hints that we may hear a few more details behind the scenes as early as the end of this week or over the weekend. Nothing is clear yet. Walker has certainly signaled that he is interested and will be offering public schools more money. This rural schools package was the first sort of specific proposals we've seen in terms of public funding for schools. He has signaled that there will be a significant investment coming from that. I would expect there to be an increase in that per pupil allotment that that districts can use per student. That's the sort of the total amount that districts can raise in state aid and local property taxes. In the old days, that used to go up by, you know, $200 a year or so. Starting in 2011, that was not just held flat, but actually was a decrease per student. So that's where districts are still trying to kind of dig back up out of that to get back to a place where they feel like they can handle costs moving forward. So I'm sure we'll see an increase in that per pupil allotment. I don't know if that'll be an increase over both years of the budget, or if it'll be maybe one increase in the first year and a little bit less in the second. You know, could it be 100? Could it be 50? We're just not sure yet what that would look like. The other thing to watch for is how much money is actually coming to districts that they can use in the classroom. In previous budgets, Walker and the GOP have funneled more money into schools, but they didn't raise that per pupil amount that districts can raise the revenue limit. So essentially it means that you pour more money into schools, but it actually flows right through the schools and just goes to property tax relief. So on paper, it looks like you boosted school funding, but really when it comes down to what districts can use for salaries and for books, that element didn't actually go up for schools. So schools are very eager to see what are the resources you can offer us that we can actually use in the classroom over the next 2 years of this budget. And I think that'll be the main thing we look for. It'll also be interesting to see if there's any recognition of the fact that urban schools and even, to a lesser extent, suburban schools have problems with their own teacher pipeline. So would there be talk of extending this proposal to train paraprofessionals to be teachers? Could that be extended to other school districts? Would that just be limited to rural schools?
And that's a lot to watch for. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Erin Richards, education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at Governor Walker's rural schools funding proposal. Our next guest noticed something about famous writing and literature from the Midwest. Most of it takes place in the past. So he set out to create an updated, contemporary Midwestern reading list, taking a look at what's changed and what hasn't.
Mark Anitakis is a book reviewer and the author of The New Midwest, a guide to the contemporary fiction of the Great Lakes, Great Plains, and Rust Belt. And he joins us now. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So when did you first notice there seemed to be this hole in the canon of Midwest literature that this was all in the past and there wasn't quite as much in the future looking at where the Midwest is today?
Well, I've been working as a book reviewer for about the past 10, 15 years, and I think there's been this habit amongst many reviewers when you talk about the fiction of the Midwest, they'll say, well, yes, the great fiction writers like Willa Cather or Theodore Dreiser or Saul Bellow or Nelson Algren, and it felt like there wasn't a lot of conversation about the Midwest as it exists in the late 20th century, let alone the 21st century. And you know, in parallel to that, there are a lot of novelists who are working now who are setting their novels in the past. That you know, if you think of writers like Toni Morrison or Ward Just or a host of others, looking back into Midwestern history. So I wanted to explore, are we really kind of stuck in a rut with our contemporary fiction looking in the past, or are we actually being a little more future-focused? And I do conclude that, you know, through looking at the past, a lot of our fiction writers are trying to reassess how true those older kind of cliched values about the Midwest really do exist.
Yeah, what were those old ideas about what it was to be Midwestern? I imagine it's things like stoicism and hard work and something leading toward, as you call it in the book, churchiness. What else was there?
Yeah, I think you can throw some of this at the feet directly at Laurel Ingalls Wilder, who, as you probably know, set her early Little House novels in Wisconsin, right on the border on the Mississippi River. I think it's interesting to read them now because they are books about children, but they are predominantly books about work and hard work and keeping the homestead running. And that, I think, has been one of the more enduring stories that we tell about the Midwest. And I think we kind of neglect other aspects of it as a result of that. I think even if you see a novelist more contemporary like Marilynne Robinson, reviewers will say, well, you know, she speaks to these, you know, home and hearthy Midwestern values. And it's almost eliding the fact that she writes a lot about problems with race and struggles with religion and fractured families and prostitution. I think kind of escaping this notion of the Midwest as exclusively hardworking and nuclear family and churchy, it's been a difficult one to escape.
Well, something nostalgic about that, too, and maybe reassuring if you're a certain kind of reader looking for a certain kind of experience, that there is this place where it seems like maybe time hasn't changed, but has it changed? I mean, is there some truth to those old home and hearthy ideas?
I think certainly there are a lot of novelists who, will look at that and want to support it. I mean, I think, certainly if you going back to Marilynne Robinson, I think that, one thing that people really kind of cling to and embrace about her is that, she writes in this very straightforward four-square style. I think there's also an urge to write about family that is of interest in the Midwest. I write that even though a lot of writers are interested in the past, there's been this great blossoming of Detroit fiction that is set in the present and certainly addressing what's happening now. Look at a novel like Angela Flournoy's The Turner House about an African-American family that is trying to navigate through what's happened in the recession and try to keep the family together in the midst of what's happened economically to the entire city and the impact it's had on that family. I think those stories still do get out there. I think, though, they do have a little bit of an edge to them.
We're talking right now with Mark Anitakis, the author of The New Midwest, A Guide to the Contemporary Fiction of the Great Lakes, Great Plains, and Rust Belt. And we're talking about contemporary Midwest fiction that takes place in the now, or at least the recent now. And Mark, let's dive into some of that. What are some books that redefine this Midwest writing genre?
I would say, to look at one particular category, I think maybe one that most everybody has heard of, think of Gillian Flynn, who I think her reputation is as writing these very twisty, dark thrillers, but she's a scholar of the Midwest. Gone Girl is set in Missouri. Her other two books are set in, that region, Missouri and Kansas as well. And she's responding to the ways that, the industrial economy has sort of faded. I mean, it's become sort of a symbol of difficulty and hard luck. Another writer I would recommend would be Bonnie Jo Campbell, who writes about contemporary lives in the middle of Michigan, or Philip Meyer's American Rust, which is a great study of life in Rust Belt, Pennsylvania. I think a lot of these writers are really trying to look at, okay, what does it mean to have a community and be in a community when you don't have those tent poles of manufacturing or necessarily the church or schools or the other relationships that I think sort of defined the region in the earlier part of the 20th century.
Jonathan Franzen is a name, is a big name, and he tends to write about families, which makes you think he's sort of these Midwestern values. He lives himself on the West Coast now, but where does he fit in all this?
He's sort of a quirky example. I think he started out his career with a novel called The 27th City, which was about his native St. Louis, and I think he was striving to make a big splash, write this sort of family story, but also this novel that has a lot of like Thomas Pynchon-like swagger and weirdness to it. And I think as he's evolved as a writer, he's tried to look more specifically about families. Certainly a novel like The Corrections is very much about that push and pull of, what does it mean to try to break away from that those Midwestern roots that you have, and how valuable are they when you keep them? But, his characters always feel, much like Franzen and himself, seems to be very conflicted about that place. It's a place where you know that it defines you, but it's also a place that you want to get away from a little bit.
That reminds me a little bit of Laurie Moore, who was a professor at the UW-Madison for a long time with a huge national profile, wrote for The New Yorker a lot, and she set her writing, a lot of it, not all of it, but in towns that really resembled Madison and the university town here. And it wasn't necessarily a place you wanted to be. It was quirky and dark and sometimes not that pleasant.
Yeah, and I seem to recall also that when Laurie Moore had left the University of Wisconsin, there was a little bit of resentment among some in the community. I think somebody had written an angry letter saying, good riddance, Laurie Moore, that you weren't really engaged in our community. And maybe that's, I don't know how true that is, but I think that speaks to a little bit of that you know, how much you cling to the notion of what you want out of, you know, your fiction in the Midwest. Think also of, in my book, I write about two books that were directly inspired by a book that you perhaps know, Michael Lisi's Wisconsin Death Trip, which is a collection of photographs and news stories that were came from Black River Falls, Wisconsin in the late 1800s. It's all very bleak. It's very much about, you know, disease and death and shootings and suicides and so forth. And there are a couple of remarkable dark novels that were inspired by that. One would be Stuart Onan's A Prayer for the Dying, which is set in one of these quarantine communities at the time, and Robert Gulrich's A Reliable Wife, which is this very gothic marriage story that involves arsenic and poisoning and bad love and bad romance. And I found myself very drawn to stories that try to kind of upend that sort of, you know, the familiar story that we have and that darken it up a little bit.
What about, this is a book I read, and we're getting short on time here, but The Art of Fielding, which took place in a, I think it was a fictionalized Wisconsin town and a university town, and it did seem to have some of that old-fashioned Midwestern sensibility, but it had some new stuff, too.
Yeah, and I found that book a little bit frustrating and maybe a little bit apart from my thesis, too, because it felt like, in many ways, a very East Coast sort of book, because it's, you know, it was the campus was very inspired by Herman Melville, and you know, that dealt a little bit more with sexuality issues and baseball issues. So I thought of it a little bit less as a novel about place. But I mean, I think, you know, there are novelists too, like, you know, say Richard Powers, who, you know, set their novels, you know, very directly in the Midwest, but also just more novelists of ideas. They're kind of struggling with more of the intellectual, technological issues that come in as well. I think that just may speak to the fact that you know, Midwestern fiction is not really stuck in the sort of rut that I think a lot of people think it may be.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Mark Anitakis, author of The New Midwest, A Guide to the Contemporary Fiction of the Great Lakes, Great Plains, and Rust Belt. He's a regular book reviewer for The Washington Post, The LA Times, and Barnes & Noble Review. His Reading from the Midwest column appears in Belt magazine.
Coming up after the news, a look at the rise of stop and frisk policing in America. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at pain management in the age of opioid addictions. We'll talk to a guest who works on these issues, trying to come up with new standards and maybe some alternatives for treatment.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life.
There are many things to enjoy about a frozen lake. For Patty C., it's a bonfire built, improbably, on the frozen lake.
The first Saturday in February and March, Lake Halley Tavern sponsor an ice fishing contest that attracts adults, kids, and dogs for a day of competitive fishing and good fun. The lake becomes a village of shacks with an identifiable ice road down the middle, snow-rutted by vehicle after vehicle, filled with anglers out here to catch northern or bass, though most settle for panfish. As a kid, I often ice fished with my parents. I sat patiently on an overturned bucket and stared through a hole no bigger than a frisbee. But the highlight for me was always a roaring fire on the ice, not lacing a waxy, an enormous maggot, onto a hook with my cold fingers, or attempting to cut through a foot of ice with a hand auger. The first winter we lived on Lake Halley, I researched how burning logs create enough ash to form a layer between the hot coals and the ice. To appease my city slicker husband, I agreed to build our fire close enough to shore so that if the ice cracks and we all tumble through, Bruce's fear, we just stand up to save ourselves. The day of our first fire on ice gathering, my 20-year-old son and I construct the fire together long before guests arrive. Alex leaves for basic training in a few weeks, and tonight is his send-off, so aunts and uncles and cousins and grandpa can all have a chance to say goodbye. Alex and I carry down brittle pine branches and chunks of oak from our covered woodpile. He carefully makes a log cabin structure and narrates as he adds log after log. You want good air movement, and you don't want the whole thing to collapse. I'd never thought of either of those points. That's why he's the Eagle Scout and ROTC cadet, while I'm the writer who pontificates on the grandeur of a glowing bonfire on ice from her youth. Tonight I have a few surprises for Alex, a cake adorned with plastic army men, and a shoveled path across the lake lit with dozens of luminaria to light our neighbor's way. This is such a fancy name for paper lunch sacks full of sand with a stub of candle inside. When the luminaria are all lit on this dark January night, they live up to their name, a word as breathy, breathtaking, as they look tonight. My son is a man now, no longer wowed by things a boy might be. Still, I want his party to be memorable, if that means Alex laughing as his tipsy 85-year-old grandpa licks frosting off of G.I. Joe boots before devouring his slice of cake, or Alex recalling a glowing bonfire on ice when he's sweltering in Fort Benning, Georgia for 4 months. Tonight our fire takes a little nudging to light, but when it finally catches, all guests ooh and ah and stamp their feet and drink their beer and pass around peppermint schnapps with hot chocolate. Kids snap pictures and instantly post them online. It's a fire on a lake, one writes. This makes me smile. What was a common occurrence in my childhood, a break from the monotony of ice fishing, is now a novelty worthy of tweeting.
Patty C. is a writer in Lake Halley. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Coming up in just a bit on Central Time, we'll talk to a Wisconsin pain management expert about alternatives to the current standards in opioid drug prescriptions.
First, there are more than 3.5 million truckers on America's roads, which makes them a great resource for groups working to fight human trafficking. Here are truck drivers sharing candidly their disturbing encounters with underage kids who are being trafficked.
My son and I were driving through Oklahoma City, had the radio on, and the guy comes on the radio, "Hey, anybody want any underage girls?"
One of the things that we saw that disturbed us quite a bit was seeing a van pull up with a woman driving, five or six girls that got out. It looked like they ranged anywhere from 15, 16, maybe 18 years old, but all of them very, very young.
This one, she didn't even look 13, 14 years old. She had no shoes on. She had a little mini skirt on.
She couldn't have been more than 14, 15 years old.
She probably looked in her 14, 15 years old. I really couldn't tell her age, but she was very young.
And I know good and well a 14-year-old, 15-year-old is not doing this on her own accord.
Truckers Against Trafficking is opening up a new line of defense against human traffickers by mobilizing truckers, truck stop employees, and the general public to help root out the growing problem. Lynn Thompson is with us now. She's the co-founder and communications specialist for Truckers Against Trafficking. Lynn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Veronica. It's very good to be with you.
Well, where did the initial idea for Truckers Against Trafficking come from?
Well, I had grown up in El Paso, Texas, where my parents owned a small motel, and truckers were one of our main customer bases. And my daughters and I have four daughters, and the five of us, along with a friend, had started an organization to fight issues of injustice and specializing in human trafficking. And pictures from my childhood came into my mind, and I thought, you know what? There are over 7 million people total in the trucking industry across the United States. They travel. We're all localized. If we could train them to understand what human trafficking is and what to do when they see it, they could play a critical role in the fight against human trafficking across this country. So I started TAT initially as an initiative of the organization that we already had. In 2 years, it had grown so large that I was working full-time at the time, and it was too much for me to handle by myself with that job, so I turned it over to one of my daughters to run, and she took it through a 501c3 process, and it has continued to grow from there.
Was part of the problem knowing what to look for? As I understand it, trafficking looks different depending on where you find it. If you find it on the street, in a house, in a motel, the highways along rest stops, it's going to look different. So how did you figure out what to train people in?
Well, what we wanted them to do was first of all, to quit seeing young girls or young boys that were coming to their trucks or finding them at rest stops or finding them at motels or whatever, to quit seeing them as prostitutes and begin seeing them as potential victims. And then learn how to ask them questions. Do you know where you're at? When's the last time you saw your family? Do you have identification papers? Where do you go to school? And if they were foggy on those kinds of answers or were crying, if they looked scared, if they were dressed inappropriately, and if they suspected that these were victims, then they needed to make a call to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. So first we trained them on what to look for so that they were able to recognize it. Did these people have tattoos that were indicated being property of someone? Did they have bruises? All of these different things so that they could recognize it and then make the call.
And was that a switch in perception that did need to happen initially, that these were not prostitutes but these were victims? Did that switch happen easily?
It's still in the process of happening. I think that oftentimes they had seen young people out there, and they were being bothered at night. Many of them had signs on their doors that they didn't want to be bothered. And we wanted them to begin to see these kids, as I say, as victims. So we wanted them to be willing to be bothered so that they could ascertain if they were victims and make the call so that they could get help. And they were more than willing to do that once they understood that these kids were being forced to do what they were doing.
I'm wondering about how this works. So if you're a trucker and you're pulled off overnight at a truck stop and you get one of these knocks on your cab door and you suspect trafficking, what do you do? Is there a tense situation where you have to try to sort of shield this child while you wait for help to come?
Well, sometimes, in the first place, we give them all a wallet card that they can carry that has critical information that they need to take down, data when they go to report, but also questions to ask and things to look for. So sometimes they may get a knock on their door and they can actually ask the questions. Other times they may see something. For instance, a driver that we gave a huge award to last year, Kevin Kimmel, was resting at a rest stop or a truck stop after delivering his load. He saw a van with blacked out windows and an RV pull in the back by trucks, and he thought, gosh, that's a little weird. Then he saw men getting out of the back of that RV, going into the store, coming back out, knocking on the door of the RV, and then going in. He thought that was even weirder. Then he saw a young girl's face against one of those windows just for a second. It was pulled back, and the RV started rocking. He thought all of that was way too weird, so he made the call. Police were out there in about 5 minutes. This girl had been kidnapped 2 weeks earlier in Iowa. She was being sold on Backpage by the kidnappers all across the country as they were traveling. Kevin happened to be in Virginia at the time that he made the call and saw her. So it can look different ways, different times. They could be in a motel or a rest stop and see somebody pull up with three or four girls in a car and one guy. And before they even get out, they could just watch what's going on in that car. And then if the girls get out and start going to trucks, they can call right then before they've even made contact, recognizing that those girls are probably being trafficked. One trucker saw a guy taking a young girl into the shower area at a travel plaza, and he didn't think that looked right. He followed them in there and then made the call. So there are different ways that it looks, but we want them to be on the lookout for situations that don't look right. And then sometimes the trafficker will proposition the driver themselves. We had a driver who was propositioned at a traffic light And he turned the guy down, but he followed the trafficker. And when he pulled into a place, then he took down his license plate number and all the information about the car and the people in it, and he made the call.
Lynn Thompson's with us right now, co-founder and communications specialist for Truckers Against Trafficking. And Lynn, listening to these stories, story after story, I mean, it strikes me, I mean, these truckers are moving around, but a lot of us travel, a lot of us use the interstates and the rest stops. Is this something everybody should be on the lookout for?
Absolutely. I think the more people that are aware that this could be happening and they could be seeing it, the more opportunities there are for raising an alarm and helping someone escape or be recovered from a trafficker. Traffickers are moving their victims across the United States all the time. That's what made drivers especially so important to us, because they're traveling all over the United States and they're trained to be observant. So why not use that as part of their daily work to understand what they're seeing in these types of cases? But yes, everyone needs to be aware.
How big a problem is human trafficking in the grand scope of things in this country?
Yeah, it happens in all 50 states. NCMEC, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, says that one in six runaways in 2014 were likely trafficking victims. There are globally 21 million victims, and 26% of those are children. It's a $150 billion profit industry. Mm. So it is huge.
So you started Truckers Against Trafficking. Are there other arenas similar to this that you might be looking at next? I remember hearing about how airlines could partner to stop trafficking during Super Bowl airline travel. Are there other areas like that that you're looking at next?
Yeah, the transportation industry overall is a major one for training. Airlines, in some cases, are already training their pilots and flight attendants to recognize traffickers and victims when they see them, and this has occurred on several occasions where victims have been recovered. Buses and taxis all need to be trained. One of the major recruiting places for traffickers is bus depots. So if bus drivers and personnel working in the bus depots are trained, they can be alert. If people who clean up in all areas, whether it's airports or bus terminals or taxi areas, if they can all be trained and vendors can all be trained, they can recognize traffickers and victims when they're walking past them. They kind of melt into the background. Nobody really sees them, but they can recognize and see what's happening from the people that are going past them.
And Lynn, just briefly, we've just got a little bit of time left, but for people who are listening and want to help, you can't train us completely, but what should we look for to help?
I think you want to see if there are kids who all of a sudden something is different, or they're not there, or they don't seem to be as available, if they're looking scared, if they're dressing more inappropriately than ever, if you're out someplace to a sporting event or a motel or a hotel for a convention, and you see a guy there with several girls, and maybe they call him daddy, but there's no way they look like they're related. Or you hear somebody talking about a quota, or he's there with them at a hotel and there's no luggage. Those are the kind of things that would make me very suspicious, and I'd make the call.
That was Lynn Thompson, co-founder and communication specialist for Truckers Against Trafficking.
This is Central Time. Super Bowl Sunday is just around the corner, and we want to hear from you about your Super Bowl Sunday plans. Are you watching the big game? Who are you rooting for? How are you watching Big Party? And of course, even if you're not into the game, there's the halftime show. Lady Gaga this year, are you looking forward to that? Do you have a favorite all-time Super Bowl halftime show performer. Call in now with your thoughts and experiences on Super Bowl Sunday at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls in just a minute at 800-642-1234.
Couple of polarizing things about this Super Bowl. Lady Gaga won. People don't like her. And also...
Some people do.
So, well, people are not excited about Lady Gaga this time around. So we'll hear about that and also the Patriots, whether or not you like them.
And the Falcons. 800-642-1234. This is Central Time.
Rob Ferret, along with WPR Travel and Holiday Vacations, will be hosting a motor coach trip to Washington, D.C. in April. The attractions include 10 monuments and memorials, 2 museums, the Flight 93 Memorial in Pennsylvania, and the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. More information on the trip is at wpr.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from Glassnickel Pizza. 19 years of employee and customer-inspired pizzas made from scratch at 8 Wisconsin locations. Dedicated to sustainability practices and community support. GlassnickelPizza.com. You take your smartphone with you everywhere you go. Take WPR with you too. The WPR app for smartphones and tablets. It's free and available now at iTunes and Google Play. WPR. Great radio, amazing app.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's pre-Super Bowl Thursday, a day steeped in tradition. Okay, no. But the game on Sunday is a big deal for a lot of people. We want to hear from you. Are you going to be watching the game, avoiding the game, getting some shopping done while everybody else is stuck around the TV? What are your plans? What are you serving? And are you looking forward to or dreading the halftime show with Lady Gaga? And what's your favorite Super Bowl halftime show or matchup of all time? 800-642-1234 is the number. 800-642-1234.
I'm not so much in it for the football. I do like to check out the ads and the halftime show, and let's see what Drew has to say about it in Prairie du Chien. Drew, hi.
Hi there.
What is your take on the halftime show?
Well, I always enjoy the halftime show, and I guess I'm not really looking forward to Lady Gaga that much. I enjoy the 80s band, some of the rock stuff more, but I specifically remember that Super Bowl about, I would say, 10 or 15 years ago where Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake were performing and had the wardrobe malfunction.
Yep, that's one for history.
Reason, that one sticks in my head.
But for some reason.
Yeah, I remember a lot of good Super Bowl performances and stuff, but that one, for some reason, that one popped up in my mind right away.
Drew, thanks for the call.
Thanks, yeah. And that is one where I tuned away from the Super Bowl halftime show, and the next day I was like, why is everybody talking about the halftime show? I had missed all of that. What's the big deal with that one?
Yep.
I missed it, but I've watched a lot since, but not that particular one.
That one's gone down in history for unfortunate reasons, shall we say.
Right.
And I think Lady Gaga will be interesting to see what she comes up with. She's super theatrical, but apparently, not everyone always interested in that. A lot of Drew, they're liking the rock and stuff for the halftime show. That's another popular way to go.
Thanks for that call, Drew, at 800-642-1234. I do like, even if I don't like the artist, somebody puts on a big spectacle. Not a huge Lady Gaga listener, but I think she'll put on a show, and that's an important thing. Let's go back to our callers. Polly is on the line in Two Rivers. Polly, hi.
Hello there, Rob. I just wanted to have an issue with you.
Uh-oh.
Yesterday, you made 2 comments, and when the show is repeated, how you don't like Bill Belichick. I am from Boston,
Uh-oh.
So you can guess who I'm rooting for. And I just want to tell you, I don't usually get to watch the football game because I used to work every weekend. So this will be the first Super Bowl that I will see in its entirety. So I don't get to see the shows. I don't get to see the game. So I'm just going to tell you what my sister told you. You hate us because you ain't us.
Thank you so much, Polly. I don't feel really strongly about it. He just kind of bugs me. But, hey, if I lived there, I'd be a fan, too. And I got nothing against Tom Brady. He went to my alma mater, so I can back him, too. So, Polly, I'm rooting for Atlanta, but I won't be devastated if the Patriots win.
I think Polly is right on in razzing you, Rob. I don't know what she's talking about with Belichick because I don't know football, but I agree with her anyway. She has some good points
there. You're on Polly's side.
Polly, thanks a lot for that. And we're going to go next to Colin in La Crosse. Colin, hi.
Hi there. So I was also thinking back to, gosh, it was a long time ago when they had Aerosmith on for the halftime show. And
I remember that.
That was a really cool direction to go in. But I know for the past couple of years they've had just little petitions going around for Metallica to get on the halftime show, and I just thought that would be really cool if they went in that direction one of these times.
Wow, that would be something.
They put on a show. They, you know, they need extra room for the drum kit. But I think, yeah, that would be a hard rockin', you know, Enter Sandman, Justice for All.
What about Kiss? Has Kiss ever done a halftime show?
I don't know. They'd have to have the Super Bowl in Detroit so they could play Detroit Rock City. That would be, I'd back that too. Thanks so much, Colin. You can still let us know what you are looking for, what you look for in a good halftime show, in a good Super Bowl, in a good Super Bowl party. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or as always, you can head over and post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're going to watch, not the game, but you are going to turn in for halftime.
I make no promises, Rob. Maybe. It is Groundhog Day, meaning people are watching for highly skilled weather forecasting groundhogs around the world to see how much winter we have left.
If you missed all the excitement, the lesser groundhog in Pennsylvania called Punxsutawney Phil did see his shadow. That would mean six more weeks of winter, according to the legends.
But, you know, Phil's for amateurs. The real deal is Jimmy the Groundhog in Sun Prairie. And this morning at Sun Prairie's 69th annual Groundhog Day celebration, Jimmy also saw his shadow.
So that is a lock, according to this completely scientific method. Six more weeks of winter, which, if I do the math right, that puts winter into mid-March, which, you know, isn't really that weird for Wisconsin.
No, it's not. I think the weirder thing would be, you know, winter ending early.
Right.
This is Wisconsin. It doesn't end that early. It's not really over till, you know, what, April?
My kids have hunted for Easter eggs in a couple inches of snow in the past. Yeah, that's not that weird. The good news, though, in neither of those cases was the mayor bitten by the groundhog, which did happen in Sun Prairie a couple few years back. So an injury-free Groundhog Day to you all. This is Central Time.